All right, we'll call the meeting of the Agriculture, Rural Economies, Veterans Affairs Finance Committee to order. Representative Faust moves the minutes of February 17th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, minutes are adopted. Members, today we have two tasks before us, as you can see. One is a carryover from last meeting. Again, our apologies, but we're going to look at a Medicaid feasibility study. If you remember last year, there were some bills introduced by myself and Senator Berglund to take a look at Medicare and Medicaid being used in our veterans nursing homes, getting them certified and understanding if that's a tool that we could use to actually bring more money in. Since that time, a study was looked at over the year to bring back better information to us. I think you're going to hear from the deputy commissioner and others that he came from California, where they did have Medicaid and Medicare certified homes. So this isn't a new idea. It's done around the country. And basically what we're concerned with as a committee is where can we get the most return for our dollars while still making sure the services are sound in those facilities for our veterans. So what are the pluses and minuses? Does it make sense to do that in any way, shape, or form? So I'm not sure who's here to talk about it, but they can start working their way up. Here they come. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the tape and let us know what you're accomplishing here with the study and where we're going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pam Barrow, Senior Director, Veterans Healthcare, Department of Veterans Affairs. And Robin Gostad is going to be presenting the study, and I think you have a PowerPoint handout there. I just wanted to let the committee know that Robin is our quality director for the department, has been with the department for a little bit over a year, and comes to us with about 20 years of experience in the corporate healthcare world and in the private sector. So very well qualified, Robin's been a tremendous asset to the department, and Robin took the lead on this study and is probably the most knowledgeable, so she will give the presentation.
Very good. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Robin Gostad. I'm the Director of Quality for the Department of Veteran Affairs as well as the Minnesota Veterans Homes. I had the opportunity to put together, on behalf of both your request and the request of our Deputy Commissioner, a request for proposal early last year to understand and to analyze the feasibility for the Minnesota Veterans Homes regarding Medicare and Medicaid certification. Early in the year, we let that RFP, according to state policy and procedure, and ended up contracting with Affinity Health Services. They began their work in May of last year and finalized their work in early November. The work was done in three phases. Because it was such a large study, and because there was a lot of complexity relative to the study, we divided the work into three phases, and Affinity led all three phases of that study, and our Veterans Homes leadership and staff provided supportive documentation, data, and what have you. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about the methodology used in all three phases, as well as some of the key considerations and findings for all three phases, as well as looking at, for all practical purposes, the so what, where do we go from here. In terms of methodology, phase one was really about data gathering. We spent a lot of time developing templates and checklists relative to financial data, cost of care data, length of stay data, and we identified the cost per patient day per each of the homes. We realigned those financial reports to industry standard.
Excuse me. Arlen or someone, can you get the overhead on? We have these overheads, and you can just put it in front of you while you talk on the screen so people can see what you're talking about. Is that what you're going off of, I assume?
Yes.
So You can get it centered. There's a zoom out and a zoom in key, and then folks out in the audience can kind of follow along, too.
Okay.
There you go. Yeah, we could give her a clean copy, and she's got her scribbling all over it.
You can see I've been thinking about this.
That's all right. We're very informal here. It's like being in your basement setting up some equipment with your kids. So we're the kids. So, yeah, zoom into that now, too.
Zoom into that. All right.
There we go.
Well, thank you. Okay. And then we established the basis for determining the Minnesota Veteran Home financial impact for the study. So really, the first phase was all about data gathering. The second phase of the study was conducted actually in two parts, part A and B. Pretty simple and straightforward. Part A was an analysis of operational considerations relative to the veterans' homes. And we had to look at several key points that were important for consideration. The first point was relative to our admission criteria and our waiting lists. Our waiting lists and admission criteria are very different in terms of a strategy for bringing new residents into our homes. You'll find that in community-based homes, they have marketing plans and community outreach that's very different for their Medicare-certified community-based homes than the Minnesota Veterans Homes. We also found that we have fewer admissions. Whoops.
I think you're on the wrong one.
There we go.
Your partner there isn't keeping up.
All righty. we'll work as a team here.
There you
quickly.
Go.
We can adapt easily. We also have fewer admissions in our veterans homes because we have longer lengths of stay. Our veterans consider the Minnesota Veterans Homes as their home, typically when they come for the remainder of their lives. You'll find in community-based homes that are Medicare certified, they have shorter lengths of stay and have higher turnaround in terms of their resident population. Part of that is based on the fact that the mission for the Minnesota Veterans Homes is very different and unique. I found that to be true as I've been with the Veterans Homes. Our veterans consider our homes as their home, and typically our lengths of stay can be decades and for sure years, where the length of stay in community-based homes is often sometimes months and sometimes short-term annual 2 to 3 year kind of turnarounds.
Do we know what the average length of stay is at our homes, our standard care nursing homes, not Hastings? I mean, is it 3 months? Is it 3 years? Is it?
Mr. Chair, it's probably 2.5. It's over 2 years. Overall, but we can get you that specifically for each of the homes.
All right.
I met a resident in the actually administrator's office at Hastings or at Minneapolis last week, who has been in the home in excess of 20 years. We have a lot of residents who have been in our homes for multiple years, and we can get you that information, and we'll bring that to you. Based on the waiting list process and the admission criteria that the homes use relative to their mission, it practically eliminates the ability of the Minnesota Veterans Homes to admit residents directly from the hospital, taking advantage of the 3-day hospital stay requirement for Medicare Part A. That's an important part of the study and an important finding, and one that didn't necessarily surprise our leadership. But the 3-day hospital length of stay requirement is an important aspect relative to Medicare reimbursement and billing. Medicare Part A has multiple requirements. The three most important requirements that are defined by CMS for residents to be in a skilled facility
and for that facility to be able to bill for their services, there are three key points. One, the resident must need skilled nursing or skilled rehab services daily and have a high acuity rating. Daily skilled services can only be provided in a skilled nursing home. So, for instance, the resident would not qualify for being able to be at home because their care needs are so great that they need to be in that kind of a setting. And the services must be reasonable and necessary in order to treat acute illness and injury. In terms of our findings for Phase 2A, we found multiple things that are, again, admission and waiting list practices vary significantly between ourselves and what you might find in a typical community-based Medicare certified home. Our discharge planning practices also vary significantly in that because we have longer lengths of stay, we discharge fewer patients or residents on an annual basis. Whereas community-based homes typically have a higher turnover rate of residents, and that helps them maximize Medicare billing. So, again, our length of stay also varies significantly. Let's see, summary. The resident acuity levels at the veterans' homes varies also from what you find in the community. Overall, in terms of, for instance, Laverne and Fergus Falls, their acuity rates are slightly lower, and Minneapolis, in terms of the veterans' homes, the Minnesota veterans' homes, Minneapolis typically runs a little higher acuity because of its location and because of the number of residents that it serves. So that puts them in a slightly higher acuity rating. That's important because the higher the acuity rating, the more access you have to revenue in terms of billing for services. Therapy service levels also vary between the Minnesota Veterans Homes and what you'd find in the community. At our Veterans Homes, we typically provide more therapy based on clinical need to our veteran residents. Versus in the community, they really have to utilize their therapy resources and emphasize and put those skill sets towards the residents that have the highest need because that's where they're going to recover the highest revenue. Our documentation processes also vary significantly. Our documentation systems are built to for most practical purposes, document clinical care needs of our residents, whereas in community-based homes, the documentation is really built to maximize payment and revenue. Our business and accounting processes also significantly vary from the community homes. We have less complex business and accounting processes. And part of the reason for that is because Medicare-based homes have to produce a cost report. A cost report really requires a very sophisticated general ledger, billing, and financial systems. And therefore, we haven't had the need to build those systems.
I'm going to interrupt you for just a minute.
Yeah.
Folks are wondering who the people without the hats are. Well, one guy's got a hat back there, and there's another one. But these are 12th grade students from Princeton High School, right? And they're participating in Minnesota Historical Society Capital Historic Sites Voice of the People, your role in Minnesota government. So they're on tour and learning about the legislature and other government today. So we welcome you. This is the Agriculture and Veterans Affairs Finance Committee, and today it's veterans. And so what we're hearing is some things about our veterans' homes and their budgets around the state as we try and figure out how to solve our budget problems we got. It's important we take care of our veterans community. So we're hearing from them. What you see here are members around the table. We have some staff sitting up there. Obviously, we have folks testifying. And the people you see in the room are general public folks or with organizations who are mainly interested in veterans today. So when you see a cap on a guy like that or a gal, probably means that, well, it does mean that they were a veteran and served our country along the line somewhere. So we welcome them, and we welcome the students in the room, and for your short stay, hopefully you learned something today, and it beats being in school, right? So whatever happens. All right, thank you. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of our methodology around Phase 2B, which is the second part of this part of our analysis, we looked at the financial and business office operations. And as I've talked about earlier, our accounts receivable and billing procedures, policies and procedures were reviewed in detail. We looked at the cost of care calculations that the veterans' homes use, including private pay, maintenance fees, and the federal VA per diems, versus looking at third-party billing that occurs in the community. And then we assessed our computer applications as well as our software, billing software needs. In terms of findings, we found again that the general ledger accounting system varies from what you'd see in the community, the simple versus the more complex, based on the requirements of reporting for Medicare and CMS. The business office and accounting systems and policies would need some significant reform. The billing processes vary. We do a very typical and straightforward cost of care calculation with maintenance fees versus third-party payer billing, which is much more complex and a very different kind of requirement. And we found that our billing systems would need some upgrading from both equipment as well as software. And then the final phase relative to our report in terms of phase three really looked at the cost-benefit analysis, what our assumptions were for that analysis, and we wanted to be sure that we had some idea of the range of requirements for an implementation plan. In order to proceed with that, we had to look at a gap analysis relative to the conditions of participation. The condition of participation are really the CMS rules and regs that govern Medicare and Medicaid billing. We did that by implementing mock surveys and life safety code analysis. The mock surveys really looked at those conditions of participation, client care needs, the rehab, skilled nursing, physician care, and other associated kinds of care practices. The life safety code analysis was really around the facility and the environment itself. So what kinds of facility upgrades relative to life safety would be required in order to become Medicare certified. In terms of our cost-benefit analysis, we looked at expenses in two ways. We looked at expenses relative to the Minnesota Veteran Home current data relative to that cost per resident day analysis based on what information we had available. The other thing that Affinity was able to do for us was to utilize cost report data from Minnesota and national community-based homes regarding Medicare and Medicaid certification. And that information came directly out of cost reports. So it's not necessarily information, and that information is publicly available. So it's not necessarily information that would be able to be compared apples to apples to our data, because those comparisons were not possible because of the way we collect our data and how we utilize our data, and our length of stay being quite a bit different, our acuity levels being quite a bit different. So we weren't able to do an apples-to-apples comparison, so that was the best that we could do relative to trying to look at the opportunity that community-based homes have. Then we looked at revenue, and we looked at revenue relative to those same cost reports and Medicare and Medicaid rates, and then we looked at the revenue that we are able to, from the Minnesota Veterans Homes perspective, generate from our federal per diems, cost of care, and maintenance fees. I just wanted to add a little bit more information relative to, and I can put my notes up on the screen. I'll have to zoom out just a little bit. I'll maybe zoom in. There we go. It's not going to be real readable for you. There we go. That's the best I can do there. I wanted to add just a little bit of information for folks relative to the two scenarios, the two financial models that we built, because I think that information is going to be kind of important for you to understand. We built two cost-benefit analysis scenarios. The first analysis that I'm going to talk about was really built on the analysis and summary of the cost-benefit for the veterans' homes if they pursue Medicare certification with no change using our same admission criteria and waiting list rules. The conclusion of that study, of that part of the study, was that three of the four nursing homes would not benefit from Medicare Part A program under their current admission criteria, waiting list, and discharge models. These homes, however, could potentially benefit from participation in Medicare Part B and D. The second scenario that we looked at was an analysis and summary of the cost-benefit for the Minnesota Veterans Homes to pursue certification and seek revision of our admission criteria and waiting list rules. However, I think it deserves mentioning here that if we were to pursue something along those lines, it would be a dramatic change of mission for our veterans' homes. Our veterans homes, again, and I just want to make sure that I emphasize it enough, are designed right now to serve the long-term care needs of our veterans, residents, and families. So it's a long-term living arrangement versus a living arrangement that is put together to serve residents' acute care needs. Also, we looked at two financial models. And we looked at those two financial models to provide you with a range of financial opportunity. So we developed a low range and a high range. Again, the low range assumes that the homes make no change to their admissions criteria and waiting list, and it's based on our current acuity mix and length of stay. The high end range was built off of the assumption that we would revise the admission process and the waiting list and change our current rules. It was also based on average to high acuity in Medicare-certified Minnesota-based community homes. So it was based on community-based Medicare-certified homes. The difficulty that we had with the study and the difficulty that I need to make sure that I emphasize with you is that there are many variables and many assumptions in that information which need to be tested. In terms of the summary around phase three, we needed to look at and determine what we would need to do and what we would need to encounter in order to proceed. There would be investment costs relative to the implementation plan. We would need probably some additional consulting time. We're looking at an RFP currently trying to detail what that consulting time would be required for and what the deliverables might be. We're looking at the additional expense relative to computers, both software and equipment. There would be extensive training needed for all levels of staff, both clinical and non-clinical. Clinical staff relative to both clinical training, HIPAA, and ongoing CMS compliance, and for non-clinical staff, ongoing CMS compliance, as well as all the changes that we would need to make in our policies and procedures. We're looking at the potential addition of some FTEs, both for billing and for training purposes. And we, of course, would need to rebuild our systems, policies, and procedures. In terms of the so what, where are we now? Which I think is an important question for us to pause and try to answer. Right now, we are currently pursuing the implementation of an analysis and implementation of Medicare Part D for the homes. We're looking at a centralized pharmacy as well as a remote dispensing model. We are analyzing Medicare Parts A and B and assessing the feasibility and cost benefit separately based on the merits for each home. In terms of that feasibility for cost benefit, we are looking at, in more detail, the opportunities and challenges around rehab, skilled nursing, and delivery of physician services. We're also looking at Medicaid and assessing the feasibility and cost benefit separately on the merits for each home relative to pursuing Medicaid certification. In terms of our goals at this time, we would like to move forward with a phased approach that positions the Minnesota Veterans Homes best for success, both short-term and long-term. And our goal is always to honor the military service of our veterans and the needs of our residents and families as we move forward and consider our options and our next steps in terms of our plans.
So that's okay, well, thank you for that. I got some basic questions, and I'll open it up to others, too. First of all, I think it's good that we're looking at this, and I think we are finding in some areas there could be some cost benefits as we restructure the way that we look for benefits for our residents at these homes. But I think it's important for the committee to think through, too, along with our veterans folks and the staff at the homes. I guess what do we want these homes to look at? Is what the way we've always done it, the way we should keep doing it, or are there different ideas and scenarios for different patient mix? I think the interesting thing for us to understand is the length of stay currently at the homes of over 2 years. Now, Representative Hosh and Otremba and others that sit on Human Services, I'm not sure what the average length of stay at a nursing home is in Minnesota, but it's certainly not anywhere near 2 years. It's probably months or weeks, or you know, so it's end of life treatment that they get, and etc. And we have other facilities now in place for that longer term care, assisted living, and other things. So one of the quandaries I think we're in, if I understand it, you can correct me if I'm wrong, the way we run our veterans homes now, if you want to be in a veterans home, you get on the list. And so the different homes compile a list of people that want to come in. And you get in based on your position on that list and who's ahead of you. If we would go to a different certification, that list process would change more based on a needs process, or could. So if you need more acute care or a higher level of care, you then would be admitted before someone who's relatively who's not up to those levels. And I'm not saying that's good or bad. We have, certainly if you're a veteran who needs that more intensive treatment and care, and a family of that veteran, you want that veteran in today. You want them to be at that veteran's facility for the next 2 or 3 months of their life, and you want them to have that kind of care and treatment and be surrounded by people that that have that. Otherwise, these folks don't get admitted right away, and then they end up going to standard care homes or other places. Am I correct on that? I'll ask that question right now.
Mr. Chair, you're correct.
Okay. So that's one of the considerations on some or all of our homes, is do we look at providing a different level of service for some Minnesota veterans who now can't get into our homes, quite frankly, because of where they're at, or do we continue to be just a list-driven when you were on it and who's ahead of you type thing, which again, both of them have their pluses and minuses depending on what you want your facility to be. The other thing I think that's important to mention when you get into Medicare and Medicaid certification is the look back. Right now, one of the benefits a veteran has is the look-back period, I believe, is 1 day for your asset preservation, whereas, again, I'm not sure in the nursing homes, Representative Otremba and Hosh, is it 3 years now, or is it, what's our look-back period for paying for it. 5 years? 5 years. So that would be a change, too, in that veterans would have to also do some financial planning and other things if they foresee using one of these facilities in the future, just like our current personnel and clients do in those homes. Is that right? I mean, that's the look back is one of the benefits a veteran has.
Mr. Chair, correct.
And again, people argue both sides of that issue, and certainly there's reasons to have that or to not have it, depending on the services. So I think, you know, those are some of the things, and it sounds like you're going to continue to work forward with this home by home and with the deputy commissioner to really come up with some suggestions on what a 21st century veterans care model looks like in Minnesota. And you know, and again, I appreciate the experience you bring from other states and looking around the country, because certainly we're not an island on this, and other states have tackled this or are tackling it now too as they try to modernize. And so we appreciate that. Do you suspect by next year at this time, for budgeting purposes, you'll have some better ideas on some of these homes and be able to advise us if, you know, again, as we put budgets together and, frankly, probably face worse budgeting headaches than we're going to this year, that you'll have some thoughts on some of that as we move forward?
Mr. Chair, I think that we will definitely we'll move forward and have a much better operational plan and particularly with Medicare Part B. That's
right.
One that's probably the easiest to pursue, and we're moving forward on that
and
one.
Again, members, that's the prescription drug and those benefits that now is it each home does their own dispensing or maintaining of pharmaceuticals and programs, and now you're looking at centralizing that for all of them?
Mr. Chair, correct.
Right. And so I think that's a good idea and a good first step, but we're looking forward to more discussion and interface with you over the summer and fall as we try and discover what we can do, and with our partners out in the service clubs and others around the state. Questions or comments to this subject? Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I guess, is, you know, we've got a nice pile of information here on the process you went through, and I appreciate all of that information. But when I went through all of that, it was missing all of the financial data to support the conclusions in the end. And I'm wondering if that's, you know, super top secret information that you can't send out, or if it was intentionally deleted, or why it wasn't in here. But more importantly, that if we could please get that information, because that you know, I went through looking for that and didn't find it. So if I could get that, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, Representative, were you looking at the PowerPoint handout or the
no.
The study itself.
Representative Faust.
These Affinity Health Services studies, we've got four of them here, I think, and I didn't see a spreadsheet or anything like that in any of them that showed, you know, the cost savings in different areas. And if they're in here and I missed them, I apologize.
And you made the statement, you obviously looked at the cost. You've got three out of four homes that could benefit on some things. One of the homes didn't, but in the future you're putting together those high and low scenarios and the other things. I assume there's cost data that would accompany all that for us to look at, too. Mr. Reinhold.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Faust, I noticed that wasn't in the packages when we received information before, and I did request that from the department since the last meeting, did receive that, and I guess it wasn't handed out today either. Was it really that would be the cost-benefit analysis? There is a portion that is mostly numbers, cost-benefit analysis, and it does have the on each home under the two different scenarios what the savings would be. And it's rather, I haven't had much time to look at this, but I believe the savings are estimated, if they implement it at the high end, to be $11 to $12 million a year. Is that approximately it?
If we reconfigured them all and went to the high end?
On page one, it shows about the range of potential financial impacts if all those were. There's not a total on this, but I just added, I believe it's like $11, $12 million a year. If perhaps the department I mean, they've done the study. It could confirm that.
Yeah, if you'd continue to work with our fiscal staff so that then they can give us a synopsis and a report, that would be helpful to make sure they get whatever information they need, because they'll certainly be providing it to this committee.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't believe that those numbers are all additive, and we'd be happy to spend some time with folks to understand those.
We'd appreciate it if you'd stop over and see Jim in his office or interface with him over the next week or so here, too, to make sure he's got all the right information. Again, we have an entire fiscal staff here, many members that also work for the legislature and try and put together these scenarios based on what you're providing them. So.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair and Representative, I apologize for any confusion regarding the documents. I actually didn't see exactly what's there, so I can't address that specifically, but we'll make sure that you need.
We'll get the raw documents, and we'll get some memos from our staff as they're put together out to members. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the directors, either one, do you anticipate any opposition or objection from the residents if these changes were made?
As Mr. Chair, Representative, changes as far as moving forward with, I think that's something that we have to take into consideration and would be part of our implementation strategy plan in educating and identifying what benefits, you know, what issues would be related to any types of changes that we do implement. So that would be something that would be very, very concerned with and working with the veteran community, so that we don't want to minimize what we're doing or put the veterans at risk with our changes.
Thank you.
And again, I that's a good question, and one, again, what you're doing is there are different groups of veterans that would be affected in different ways, and so for some it would be a very positive thing. Oh, my gosh, I can get my father in there next week. Mm-hmm. For others, it's, oh, now I got to wait on the waiting list another year or another, you know. So, but they're all veterans, and we're affecting. It'd be interesting to do an analysis of your list, too, and how many come on that list and fall off and never get admitted because of the, you know, end-of-life issues, and they're just not around long enough to utilize the facility. It'd be kind of interesting to see those numbers, too, and understand, you know, which population would be better served under which scenario that way, too. So if you could kind of dig through that a little bit and provide us some guidance on what those waiting lists look like and how many never make it to the top, I think it'd be interesting for us too. Other questions, comments on this? I think it's a good start. Again, I think as our oversight in the Veterans Department of Veterans Affairs, we appreciate the leadership over there. Oh, Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, I appreciate you bringing forward the study today. I had a couple questions. Just in general terms, can you give us an idea, if we were to move from the current model that we have at our veterans' homes to a model that we see practiced out in the, you know, the nursing homes and the facilities in our communities, where people are usually only there for a couple months and they have a pretty high level of need and they're served, and then as soon as they, you know, recover to the point that they can transition back into assisted living or back to their home, they do. Do you, in general terms, can you give us an idea, if we move to that model, is it in the end going to cost us more since we have the majority of veterans in our veterans' homes with high level of need?
I think that's a good question. I just follow up. I don't mean to interrupt, but that is a possible model, too, to have the home for the more acute care, and as you say, as they recover or get better, move them back closer to their community in a veterans facility that might not be as large but is an assisted living dedicated to veterans out there, or some other scenarios that we could envision going forward. Are we thinking through models like that are certainly out there in the standard care arena?
Mr. Chair, committee members, we're open to looking at all options and alternatives, and with Deputy Commissioner Acevedo leading us, you know, and doing our strategic planning, I think as healthcare changes, as what we're seeing, you know, around the country, I think, again, we work within the constraints that limit us, but that doesn't mean we look outside those and see what else opportunities there are and what we can do. And the bottom line is how can we best care for those veterans that deserve the best that we can give.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, just I would encourage the department to look at all of the different models. And, mm-hmm. and on a number of the communities that I represent, there's the nursing home, and then attached to the nursing home is the assisted living or independent care facility. And if we have to go to that model in some of our areas, then it would actually be a cost benefit to us, because then you could get in under more of the Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement, and then also still provide the services to those veterans that want more of the community, the sense of community, the home care model. I would encourage us to look at that if we don't already have that in place now at all of the facilities throughout the state. I just think that we do need to look at providing better care, but providing it efficiently.
Okay. Any other discussion from members? All right. Well, this isn't the end of this topic. This is the beginning of it, and we appreciate that, and we look forward to you and the department continued work and leadership on that, and again, working with the legislature, hopefully, to move in a positive direction for everything involved here. So, all right, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Members, now we're going to move into the today. We'll finish off the day with Veterans Affairs. The governor's budget is out, and certainly we want to understand what that budget said in the arena that we look at. Tomorrow we'll be doing Department of Agriculture, Board of Animal Health, AURI, et cetera. We have a couple very important people up here now at the table to guide us through that and answer our questions. And members, you have a number of sheets in your file. I will tell you some of them are newer, some of them are older, some of them are meaningless, some of them have more detail, but we're just trying to provide you everything that comes across our desk as we see it. And I will tell you we've been making some requests too for further information. I just got a copy of some carry forward summaries too that, you know, we generally get periodically, but looking at the accounts from every veteran's home to all our pots of money and what's being carried forward. Members, as we look at veterans, we certainly know we're going to do everything we can to protect these budgets and do whatever we have to do to put those monies forward that take care of our veterans and the programming that we have. But certainly it behooves us to not just take a blind eye either. I mean, we are the legislature with oversight, and we work with the department on that in a very proactive and positive way. And so we want to understand, we want to make sure we're not wasting money either. I mean, if there is additional money in some of these funds that isn't going to be used, it should be transferred and used for other veterans' funds where we have had shortages or where we have some opportunities for some new services. I know we're going to have some discussion on the CORE program and other things that may or may not need a little bump before we get to the end of the fiscal year. We've got new things we're trying to implement, and if we're just locked in saying, well, that was our appropriation, we'll use every cent of it, without actually understanding those carryovers, will they be needed or not, is there opportunities in other areas, you know, it doesn't mean the veterans money will go to, you know, the DNR, but it does mean it could be used for other veterans programs, and we certainly want to understand that with you as we struggle to find money for these programs and new ideas that come forth too. So with that as a backdrop, I'll let you start and try and guide us through some of the changes or opportunities you see coming in this supplemental budget.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Mike Puglisi, Deputy Commissioner of Programs and Services for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Thank you for having us this morning. You know, this session, you know, being very mindful of the current economy and where we're at, we certainly weren't looking to grow any further. There are certainly things that we would like to be able to enhance and improve upon that we provide to the veteran community, but now is not the time. So being mindful of that, you know, the governor came out with recommendations that were going to keep us whole and that we're going to put some money where we absolutely had to have it to continue to provide the services and the care that we are expected to provide. On the programs and services side, the only thing that we're looking at for increasing a budget for is our honor guards. It's a program that we created a few years ago to help support the veteran service organizations out there that provide this wonderful service.
And before you go any further, is there any specific document we should be looking at as you're talking? I mean, I love listening to you, but I'm a visual person, too.
The document that, you know, on the front has a date of February 23rd, 2010, two-page. The very back sheet, if you turn it over to the last page, will have some information on the honor guards.
Okay, yeah, and that 46 of 65, it's actually the third page, yeah, of the handout. You'll see it there. Yeah, if you could kind of help us.
Sure.
Guide us that way, too. A lot of us like to take notes or keep these for future reference, too.
So. Mr. Chair, members, what you'll see there is the number of recipients that have received the $50 stipend and the total dollar amount that it's equated to. And you can see it really assists quite a few veteran service organizations out there. There is no other support for them to provide this service. And what we do internally, the language allows for us, is we give priority to those service organizations that don't have any type of revenue from gambling. And there is a fair number of those. We went through the money fairly quickly, and there was a lot of interest from the veteran community asking us to move forward and continue this program. So this is one that we did ask the governor to consider putting in as a supplemental request, and he did. And we're thankful for that.
So it's $100,000?
It's $100,000 per year, $200,000 for the biennium. And it goes a long way in assisting those service organizations with providing this very needed service.
So remind me, Mr. Puglisi or Mr. Reinholtz, the out years, 12 and 13, is that new money too? Was this just a one-time that we put in last year, no tails, or did we account for those tails already?
Mr. Chairman, you're correct. This was one-time only when it was appropriated previously.
Okay, so that's why we're seeing it in 12 and 13, too, because it was not, we were going to revisit it next year, but you blew through it already, huh?
Mr. Chair, we did.
That's all right. All right. Continue.
You know, there's not a lot much more to say about this program other than it really is a very needed service. You know, that the National Guard, they can provide this service for their Guard members that need it, but it's a large state, and unfortunately there's a lot of burials taking place. They can't do it for everyone, and that's where our veteran service organizations that have these honor guards who do a tremendous job, they can step in and provide this service.
Just remind us, how do they get reimbursement? Do they, the individual posts or whatever, apply directly to you or through county veteran service offices, or how do they, in case we've got some at home that aren't doing it?
Mr. Chair and members, they apply straight to us. We work closely with the National Guard. They help us verify that these honor guards actually took place, and then they make applications, a one-page form, and it comes through our finance division. We take care of it. They can certainly reach out to their service, you know, the CVSOs in their county to find out more about this program. But we handle it internally.
Okay.
So it's one of those things that's a very nice thing to provide. It's a great service that they offer. Not a lot of people out there can do it, you know, if they're not doing it. It's not a lot of money, but it goes a long way.
All right. I know you've got Mr. Acevedo's here with some changes in adult daycare and in Fergus Falls. Maybe you can go over those, and then we can get into other department issues after that, since we have it in front of us right now on this same supplemental sheet.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Oh, and you've got more. Okay, you've got another handout, too, right?
I do. Actually, if you look at page 46 of 65.
Yep.
Handout. And the top of that handout, it speaks to Fergus Falls expansion operations and Minneapolis adult day operation, daycare operation.
Okay. And then we have a separate handout that is a little more detail on both the adult daycare and the Fergus Falls home.
Exactly.
Okay. Proceed on both of those.
Okay. Great. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gilbert Acevedo, Deputy Commissioner for Veterans Health Care, Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs. A little background on the supplemental budget request. This was part of a bonding that was approved for both projects for the Fergus Falls Special Care Unit, which is a 21-bed addition to the existing home. The special care portion of that is for dementia, Alzheimer's care at that home. And the bonding request was initially, it was not in the governor's budget bonding request in 2008, but it was picked up by the legislature. It was brought through and then passed through as part of the bonding bill. Part of the bonding request, whenever we submit anything that would have tails or any additional operational funds, it's also included on the budget pages when we put that together. And that's where we are now. The Fergus Falls, we received the 35% funding for the Fergus Falls through the legislature through bonding. We put it on the United States Department of Veteran Affairs bonding list or the construction list. It was not picked up initially in the current year's budget, but then through the stimulus appropriation, American Recovery Act, additional funds were provided to the United States Department of Veteran Affairs, which brought down the list, went down the list, and Fergus Falls was actually captured at that point. It kind of moved things along a little quicker than what we had expected, but it's a good thing for our veterans' home, and it's also a good thing for Minnesota in that we have people actually currently working on that project as we speak. So the funds that we're looking at, we're now entertaining the opportunity of opening up the Fergus Falls Special Care Unit in as early as this coming December into the spring. And what we're requesting is a $1.3 million request for this year as a supplemental budget request.
And the breakdown, I'm looking at your other page now with the breakdowns. I'm trying to understand some of the categories there. This building is adjoining the Fergus Falls. It's not a separate, is it? Or,
Mr. Chair, no, it's part of the existing building.
So you've got some efficiencies there, obviously, with food service and laundry and other things that you do. And I assume those are all broken down within these categories somewhere. I guess what I'm asking for is if you could give me an expanded categorical instead of a summary on that, on some of how you got to those numbers would be helpful, so we can take a little deeper look at them.
I think, yeah, we can provide that. I'm pretty sure we provided that information to Mr. Reinholtz this morning.
Oh, okay. Mr. Reinholtz.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I had asked for that information. Typically, when we get change requests from items in the past, the governor has sent over detailed information. As you know, this year they sent a line typically, so I have been requesting that information from agencies and did receive some this morning. I will put a summary together on that for the committee, and I think that probably would want to have a hearing maybe with the department at some time in the future when you had more information.
Okay, we'll look to get more information on that and take a look at it. One of the issues that continues to come up and frankly I think is misunderstood in this legislature, and we continue to work with you and our fiscal folks to better understand it. When we see something like this Fergus Falls open, people go, oh, there's another, you know, people over on my human service friends will say, oh God, there's another, you know, $2 million a year you're going to ask for Fergus Falls, and oh my gosh, you know, where are we going to get the money? Well, the fact is, if Fergus Falls wasn't there, these patients are still getting treated somewhere. So it's not an additional, these people didn't fall out of the sky. They're Minnesota residents that were going to be treated at a facility anyway. So what we're doing is transferring money from that pot where they would have been treated and setting it down over here. And hopefully, I'm hopeful in the future as we put these together that we may actually save money by accessing veterans vouchers and other things that we do, and the efficiency of our homes when we add on facilities like this. But we continue to interface with you because I think that's a point that we have to be very strong in making, that whenever we open a veterans home or a veterans facility, doesn't mean we're creating something brand new. We're actually transferring from what all these people are patients, all these people are going to have to be cared for somewhere within our state system, and we're just giving an opportunity in a veteran system where, again, we hope we can be more efficient and offer some things that they don't in the other facilities. So I think that's a story we all need to take to our caucuses and to our colleagues on other committees to help them understand that, because this isn't just budget inflation. This is budget relocation, quite frankly. And we're in these silos. You know, when I go to Huntley and he finds out, well, there's 21 people you don't have to treat, but we're treating them over here, you got to move that money. That's what finance committees and others are for, is to move those dollars around where they're needed. And so we have to continue to make that case. But again, I'm counting on you and your staff to help us out with that as we go forward in all the different areas that we have, whether it's adult daycare or extended care nursing homes or whatever it is, that we keep patting ourselves on the back on efficiencies and the reason we're doing what we do. So, all right, you got something here for Minneapolis adult daycare.
I do. The adult day care project for the Minneapolis home that started around 2005, we're bonding, it was a bonding request from the Veterans Home Board at the time, was approved. We received bonding dollars appropriated to the department or to the Veterans Home Board. The project got put on the waiting list for the United States Department of Veteran Affairs construction list, has moved up the list, got approved as we went along. And we're starting now the renovation. And what this is, a one-time startup. Our calculations based on the VA per diem that we get, what the residents would pay, would take care of the ongoing operational costs of that adult day. We're going to look at the first year, analyze that, and take a harder look just to make sure that our analysis is correct. And if not, we will then come back and talk to the committee again and explain where that went. But as it stands right now, the request is for $475,000 as a startup, just so we can hire the staff, get things going, so we can go ahead and start the adult day.
And Minneapolis is the only site we have adult daycare?
Currently, well, it's interesting. Currently in the United States, there is only one state that operates adult day through attached to one of their veterans' homes, and that is in New York. Minneapolis will be number two. There's various reasons as to why that's that way.
Why is it that way? Give us those reasons.
The reason, first of all, when you put an adult day program, an adult day health program in particular, you want to take more of a social model where you have people dropping off their loved ones, or you pick them up, you bring them to the adult day, and you provide activities and things that will be helpful in the activities of daily living for those veterans. With the way the VA has it structured, when they come in to conduct what's known as surveys at these facilities, it's more of a medical model. So they take more of kind of a survey that you would have in a nursing home versus an adult day. So they require you to have OT, PT, speech, various other disciplines that become very expensive to operate. And so a lot of facilities, veterans homes throughout the nation, don't want that additional scrutiny, you know. But as a state and as a Department of Veteran Affairs, we feel that this is a service that our veterans can certainly benefit from, and the VA is in the process of changing their rules and regulations on how they survey these particular facilities. So we're willing to take that chance with the additional scrutiny to provide the service to our veterans.
Have you drilled into the federal rules? You just talked about some changes coming. I know that my office has called you, frankly, on a district issue. My adult daycare at Bethesda Nursing Home in Wilmer does take veterans vouchers for veterans out there. However, the federal VA has just downsized from, I don't know what it was, 3 or 4 days to like 2 days a week that they'll pay for. So all of a sudden, this veteran who was going and getting an adult day 3 or 4 days a week now is limited in the number of days they can get. And that was kind of troubling to our adult daycare. And we were trying to understand through your office and the folks you know why that's going on, or if you can offer any insights to that, and or does that affect what you're doing too? Are they reconfiguring the allowable days of adult daycare for veterans across the country, or
the adult day, Mr. Chair, the adult day program that we're looking to start up is not going to affect the federal VA's adult day program. This is in addition to that program. Since our jurisdiction here in the state of Minnesota, we have four different VAs that service us. Each one, due to their budget, makes different adjustments. And so I really couldn't answer the question as to why they are cutting the days, but I can certainly, as we are doing, research the information and get back to your office.
I think it'd be helpful, because I think that's not just unique to, obviously, Wilmer Nursing Home or adult daycare facilities. So I think that's something we're starting to see, and be nice we had some answers to that, and or as we look, you know, in the future, provide benefits, do we give a handout to some of those folks if they need it on a, you know, case-by-case or periodic basis? But that would be helpful. So the same way, we want to see a little expansion, and maybe we'll see that in a future hearing on what the costs are you're calculating here. And obviously, we don't see any tails yet. You're going to wait with that request for next year when you have a better idea on some of these costs, and you'll put that into your overall budget request for the next biennium?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. We're anticipating and hoping that the facility will pay for itself, and as the previous presentation spoke to our opportunity to look at Medicare Part D, Part B, Part A,
private other, pay, other anything services, you can get your hands that on that people right. Have the ability to pay.
That's okay.
All right, questions on that, members, or on either of the homes facilities? Mr. Reinholds.
Mr. Chairman, I noticed there's inconsistency in the numbers on some of the handouts, and I just wondered if the department can have an explanation. When I look at on page 46 of 65 that was referred to on the Fergus Falls expansion of operations in 2012 and 2013, it shows $2.7 million. And on the handout that we were given over here on Fergus Falls, I believe shows considerably less than that.
And maybe you added
perhaps
up.
That could be explained.
It says 1.379 and 1.375 for 12 and 13, which if you add them up, I'm going to guess comes at 2.75. Is that a math? Okay. We're getting
Chair,
some nods in the audience from your fiscal staff that maybe that was an arithmetic error.
Not necessarily, Mr. Chair, if I can ask if our executive budget officer, Kirsten Larson, can come up
Please.
And answer that question.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Kirsten Larson. I'm a budget officer with Minnesota Management and Budget, and I can testify that this was an entry error on my part. I'm willing to take the blame. The correct numbers should be, I think, 1.379 in fiscal year 12 and 1.375 in 13.
So it's roughly half of what's reported on the supplemental
exactly.
sheet. Okay. That's a good catch. Anything else you want to take blame for before you? No, I'm just teasing. I'm teasing you.
I'm good.
All right. All right.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. All right. Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a question on the Fergus facility. How are the costs to the resident calculated? On what basis do they pay? I mean, you get a federal per diem. But based on what the resident can afford to pay, or how's this figured out?
Mr. Chair,
because that would vary as to each person, then if they do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, it's based on the resident's ability to pay, but we calculate our cost of care the same across the board. So when we identify our cost of care, all the veterans that are in our facility would be based the same. the difference is that is their ability to pay. And of course, we do get a VA per diem. That's dollars that we get from the federal government based on the number of days that that veteran is currently in our facility.
And do you, Mr. Chairman, and Deputy Acevedo, do you get, is the per diem higher for the levels of care, for example, the dementia folks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, the way the VA has it set up is that the different levels of care, and the only thing that the VA will authorize VA per diem is for domiciliary care. Okay. It'll authorize adult day. It'll also authorize skilled nursing care. And the each level of care is the per diem that's authorized is different. And for instance, the lowest that we would get would be domiciliary. The next would be adult day, and then the most that we would get in the $77 per day range is skilled nursing.
So, Mr. Chairman and Deputy Acevedo, is the these residents cost more money then? Is the cost per resident then higher for us to assume?
Mr. Chair? Representative Magnus, as we go through, it really varies because we can have someone that may not have the ability to pay, but we still provide the care. So in that case, yes, it costs more for us to take care of that veteran than what the VA is reimbursing us for. However, there are other cases where we would have someone that would pay full cost of care, and depending on their acuity and the care that we need to provide, that might be different. But as a standard, what the VA is providing the state in the VA per diem for the care does not cover the full cost of care.
Thank you. So just to follow up, does the VA have any guideline? I mean, you say, let's take this 21-bed unit. You're going to calculate the cost of care for this this new unit. Divided by 21 obviously becomes a cost of care per resident, and then certainly you go out and say, okay, I get so much for a voucher, or this person has long-term care insurance, or this person has the ability to pay privately, this person has other insurance, whatever it is, and that's how you bring your monies in. And I understand it varies per patient, but is the federal VA overseeing that to say you have a ceiling too? I mean, I can see a scenario where I could calculate anything I want for cost of care. I assume they have some guidelines too, or do they not? Do they just say, no, here's the set veterans voucher and you get it, and however you take care of it beyond that is up to you and the state? And can you discuss that a little bit?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the VA, in order for us, a veteran, to qualify for a particular level of care, there are forms that we need to fill out and submit. The exact form is the 1010-SH, and that form has an assessment tool that is done and signed off by different disciplines within the nursing home. What then happens is that that veteran is certified for that particular level of care. So if we have a veteran, this 21-bed as an example, Fergus Falls is going from 85 to 106 beds. Those are all skilled nursing. The 21-bed special care is going to be for dementia care and Alzheimer's care in particular. But our per diem for skilled nursing is the same across the board. Our rules in Minnesota as to how we calculate our cost of care is what dictates how we come up with the fees that we develop for those particular residents. The VA, when they come out and do their surveys and look at how we calculate our cost of care and everything, they take a look just to make sure that the veteran isn't being overcharged, as an example, but it really is state by state determined by the rules that the state writes in law.
All right. Anything else to Fergus or the Minneapolis Adult Day? Okay. Beyond that, then, I'm not going to go deep into it. And members, you don't have this. I was just handed it this morning. It came in. I have a sheet on the carry forward summaries. Mr. Puglisi, roughly $3 million if you add up all these accounts. I'm just doing it in my head, give or take. Probably $3 million plus when I look at it here a little closer. I guess we need to drill down into some of these with you offline as well as in the committee here to understand some of the carryovers. You know, some are trust accounts, some are
veteran services contributions. So some of these are probably dedicated accounts, but we have some larger balances, central services over $1 million. I'm also curious, it's not on here, and I think we need to take a look at it. Last year, as members remember, we put in $1.5 or $6 million for our GI Bill money, and I'd like to get an update on that from you and the higher ed folks. We're almost through a full school year, at least as far as financial aid would go. We should understand the needs. Are we using that money or not? And again, I don't want money just laying around this place, because if we don't use it, someone else will, which is the other reason. These carryover amounts are also being looked at by Ways and Means and finance people outside of this room. And so we need to understand them better, because we are going to be asked about them. And before they just disappear off our spreadsheet, we need to, interface. I'm using interface a lot. I don't know why I'm doing that. I've never used that word in my life.
Mr. Chair, members, we'd be very happy to interface with whoever you want us to make sure you fully understand.
Very good. And Mr. Reinholtz, is there, what kind of information do you need to understand these? Are we being clear enough? Or because, again, we're doing this on your behalf, because while I love Minnesota management and budget folks, we're the legislature, and they're going to have other ideas for some of this money. So,
Mr. Chairman, members, the chair was correct. I mean, routinely, fiscal staff look at carry forwards, and in years of reductions, they're usually pretty high on the list of ways to reduce agency budgets. Assuming that they didn't need the money last year, what are they going to use it for this year? Because the base is also in their budget also. So this one, if you recall, this was a little issue last spring where I estimated there would be $3 million worth of carry forward, and offered that up as a potential cut in this budget last year. And the department at that point came forward with a plan on how they were going to spend that $3 million, but apparently that plan didn't go through because they carried forward $3 million into this year. I'm asking them for some information on what the plan is to use it this year. I haven't received most of that information at this point, and I certainly will share it with the committee when I do receive it.
So the quicker we can get that, the better. I can tell you that, you know, I don't know if they've been officially set, but by Easter break, we're pretty much probably going to be done with our bills, which is, you know, the first week in April. So the clock's ticking, and the sooner we know, I'm already being pushed by leadership to understand these budgets, and they're asking me about the Fergus and the other things, and so I'm in there advocating right now, but I don't have answers to this yet. So,
Mr. Chair, members, we'll get with Mr. Ryan.
Over the next week or so, if you could sit down over a cup of coffee, go through this, and provide him with whatever information he needs would be very helpful.
Yes.
Okay. Anything else for the committee or anything else? Ag reminder, we have corn growers reception tonight. For those of you that are interested, 5:30 to 8:30 at the Crown. Always a nice event, well attended. And tomorrow is Farm Bureau's President's Dinner. If you have an RSVP'd, I'm sure they'll find you a seat for that nice meal, too. Any other announcements? Anything else? Otherwise, we do appreciate you coming. I think it's been a very productive day, and it's a good start to where we need to go. So
thank you
with that,
members.
We're adjourned.